You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. He'll be back next week. Coming up, during the pandemic, millions of families were suddenly thrust into a new world of work from home and remote learning, and working women in particular bore the brunt of the economic downturn and childcare responsibilities. We'll take a deep dive into this issue in just a bit. Now, Governor Tony Evers signed the state budget yesterday, a budget that was written by Republicans and includes more than $2 billion in tax cuts. It comes after state Republicans cut billions in spending from Evers' original proposal, eliminating policy items like legalizing pot and expanding Medicaid. We're talking about what got funded, what got vetoed, and all the politics surrounding the state budget. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad that Governor Evers signed this budget into law? Are you happy to see income taxes getting cut? What are some of the things you wanted to see get funding in the budget but maybe didn't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. She's also the co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, JC, thanks so much for having me.
So let's kick off our conversation with some of what Governor Evers said about signing the budget. Here he is at an event in Whitefish Bay yesterday.
In many ways, this budget presents a false choice between the priorities the people of the state care about and deserve. But after 8 long years of politicians making decisions for all the wrong reasons, I ran to be governor of this state and promised I would always put people before politics.
Not long ago, Governor Evers said vetoing the entire budget was an option. And, you know, there were some questions leading up to the other day, you know, what exactly was going to get cut. Why then did we see him sign the budget more or less as it had been? Of course, with some things were removed, but we'll get to that in a bit.
So basically what the governor said yesterday was that he actually didn't have an option when it came down to it about signing the budget this time around. And that was partially or big reason for that, really, that he called out was not signing the budget would put Wisconsin in a place where it might miss out on billions of dollars in federal COVID-19 stimulus money. Essentially, what could happen is if he vetoed the budget, the Republican legislature and himself weren't able to come to another agreement, set another budget, the state wouldn't meet requirements for receiving that aid, in particular for K-12 schools and higher education across Wisconsin. And that funding equals more than $2 billion, $2.3 billion. So Evers just said, you know, I'm not going to put that amount of money on the line. I'm not going to risk that. I'm going to sign the budget and ensure that we get that money from the federal government.
So before we get to the political fight over the budget, can you walk us through some of the main elements of the spending plan? What did we see get funded?
So obviously, this is a pretty big document, so I won't go through everything. But some of the highlights, something that has been talked about a lot by Republicans and Democrats this budget season is broadband funding. That was really kind of thrown into harsh relief during the pandemic, the disparity between urban and rural communities in Wisconsin in terms of who has high-speed internet and who doesn't. So this budget includes $129 million to expand broadband to communities that don't have it or don't have sufficient speeds right now. Another thing that both Republicans and Democrats have pointed to are state rate increases for nursing homes, for personal care workers, for family care workers. There's a 4-year extension of the state stewardship program where we buy land and preserve that land for public use. $19 million for school mental health, a 2% increase for special education costs for schools. And then a big one that folks have likely heard about for several years now, the expansion of I-94 in Milwaukee County. That got a green light under this budget. That's been kind of a back and forth issue for several years now.
Now, another piece of the budget that got a fair amount of headlines were some tax cuts that Republican lawmakers put in there. You know, how will they work and who are they really geared towards in the state?
That's really the biggest part of this budget, I think, and what we're going to hear a lot about over the next year or so. I think it's not just going to be in this kind of budget season where we talk about these tax cuts. I think it's going to continue into the 2022 campaign for the governor for sure and for lawmakers. So what this cut would do, it's initially it was introduced at $3.4 billion by Republican lawmakers last month, kind of late in the budget process. As the governor signed it, he did make some small changes. It's down to about $2.6 billion, but it preserves the biggest part of the tax cut, which is lowering income taxes in Wisconsin for the largest income tax bracket. So this applies to a lot of folks, and it's taking their tax rate down from 6.27% to 5.3%. That alone is supposed to cost about $2.4 billion over the next couple years. And to give folks a little bit of context, it really it depends on how much money you make, how much you're going to save. But for a family that earns between $50,000 and $60,000 a year, the average savings would be on income taxes $172 annually.
We are talking to Laurel White right now. She is WPR's state capital reporter, and she's with us to talk about the state budget that Governor Evers signed into law yesterday. So obviously, Governor Evers didn't get to set his whole agenda. The Republicans didn't get to set their whole agenda. What were some of the things that the GOP cut out of the budget that Evers had wanted in the budget?
That's a really long list. So the governor proposed a lot. It was a really expansive budget when he rolled it out earlier this year. And one of the first steps that the Republican-controlled legislature, the Republican-controlled state budget committee did was remove about 400 of the governor's different proposals from the budget. Some of the big ones were the Medicaid expansion, accepting that federal expansion of Medicaid, and the $1 billion incentive that comes with it. You mentioned this earlier, legalizing marijuana. The governor also would have raised the minimum wage in Wisconsin, and he would have rolled back some of the union laws that were passed under former Governor Scott Walker's kind of, iconic piece of legislation, Act 10. So big policy things that Governor Evers proposed that certainly didn't make it in this final budget.
And it's a two-way street. The governor did get to veto some things, but they weren't necessarily as extensive as maybe some political watchers thought they would be. What kind of cuts did we see come from the governor?
I think it's a really good point that these budget vetoes weren't as big as we've seen in the past. There are a couple factors, a couple reasons for that that we can get into. But for context, the governor issued 78 vetoes for the last budget. Among them was a measure that increased K-12 education spending in Wisconsin by $65 million. So that was kind of the big thing last time. This time, he didn't really do anything like that. He says he couldn't. Again, we'll talk about that. But some of the things that he did do with his 50 partial vetoes, he eliminated a $550 million transfer out of the state's general fund into its so-called rainy day fund. Basically, Republicans wanted to transfer that amount of money from the state's checking account, for all intents and purposes, into its savings account. The governor said, the rainy day fund is in really good shape right now, really high levels. Let's keep that money in the general fund so we can use it for things like schools if we want to. He just didn't think that transfer was necessary. So that's a big one and something that we may see some more conversation about as Evers kind of pushes lawmakers to consider, we've got $550 million sitting in the general fund. Maybe we can spend that on things like schools in the coming months. So we'll keep an eye on that. The governor also eliminated a Department of Workforce Development study that would have kind of looked into a possibility of a sliding scale for unemployment benefits in Wisconsin. So it would have changed or looked at the possibility of changing unemployment benefits, whether that's how much money you get or how long you're eligible, based on what the state unemployment rate is. Evers said he didn't want the state to move forward with that, so he deleted that study. And then another one, and there were 50 of these, and I won't go through all of them, I promise, was something that he vetoed in the last budget as well. And that was a limit on the amount of state money that could be spent on security for the lieutenant governor's office. He said that that should be at the discretion of, you know, the professionals that oversee that and shouldn't be limited by the legislature.
We are talking to Laurel White right now. She's Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter and the co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. She's with us today to break down what made it and what got vetoed in the state budget that Governor Evers signed yesterday. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Were there things that you felt didn't get enough funding in this budget? If you work in education, what do you think about the levels of school funding that were approved? What questions do you have about the budget process and what comes next? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the state budget. Governor Tony Evers signed that spending plan into law yesterday. Laurel White is with us now. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're taking your calls about the budget at 800-642-1234. Now, Laurel, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Governor Evers and what he did or didn't opt to veto. And what has come up a lot during this conversation about the budget is the unique powers of the veto that the governor's office and right now Governor Evers has. Can you really quickly talk about just kind of how unique the veto power is in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, or I think it's really interesting. I might be a little biased, but basically the governor of Wisconsin has a lot more authority than other governors across the country. So sort of the typical situation for a governor when he or she receives the budget is that they can make changes to appropriations. So they can make a number smaller, they can make a number bigger, and that's kind of the limit of their authority. In Wisconsin, the governor can change policy language as well. So it's not just limited to changing those numbers. The governor of Wisconsin can change, you know, numbers, punctuation. They can delete words. They can delete entire sentences in language that's policy related, that isn't, you know, allocating a specific amount of money, you know, in that little bit of the budget. So it's a really interesting thing. Over the past, you know, few decades, that power has kind of been chipped away. Some specific actions, like deleting individual letters from words to make new words, if you believe it, that's a thing that used to happen, or deleting words from sentences to combine sentences and make new sentences. It's also a thing that's not allowed anymore, but was fairly recently. So, you know, those things are gone, but even the power that remains is fairly expansive, especially when you compare it to other governors.
Thank you for that lesson here as it comes to the veto powers, which is really interesting, just the amount of discretion, certainly that there used to be, but maybe a little less now, but still definitely different compared to other governors. Now, Governor Evers said that this was a bipartisan plan, and some Republican lawmakers cried foul on that. Republican Representative Mark Bourne shared some of his reaction to Evers' approval of the budget yesterday. Here's what he had to say.
Personally, I find it laughable and hypocritical that just 6 months ago, when Governor Evers introduced his budget and he proposed an over $1 billion tax increase, he was given the opportunity to lead and propose tax cuts on for the hardworking families of Wisconsin, and he failed.
So Governor Evers has said that, you know, as part of a campaign pledge that he would reduce taxes specifically for, you know, middle class families in the state. Republicans are saying, you know, this was our our idea. You know, where is the political infighting happening here in terms of, you know, the budget moving forward?
This is absolutely a fight that I think we're going to continue, again, sort of the conversation about this income tax cut into next year, into the campaign season. Basically, the governor is kind of taking credit for this tax cut. He's saying that this tax cut fulfills a promise that he made in 2018 to cut middle class taxes by 10%. And Republicans are really upset by that because this proposal wasn't the governor's proposal. It was their proposal. And they point out that the governor's initial budget plan actually increased taxes by about $1 billion. So they're saying, hey, what you actually called for is very, very different from the thing that you're now kind of, you know, touting as a big accomplishment in this budget. And the governor kind of pushes back on that and says, well, I signed it. I made this law. I made this happen. And, you know, that's an important part of the process. It couldn't happen without me. So I think that we're going to continue to see kind of this back and forth of who can claim this tax cut and who can kind of talk about it as an accomplishment.
We are talking to Laurel White right now. She's WPR State Capitol reporter. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Jay in Two Rivers. Hi, Jay. So it sounds like we might have actually lost Jay. But the note that I received from our show director said that, you know, according to Jay, taxpayers would get more bang for their buck if there wasn't a tax reduction for most of us. Same amount of money could be invested in the things that we need. That came from Jay in Two Rivers. Are you hearing anything at the state capitol that mirrors what Jay brought to the show?
Absolutely. I think that that's you can make a fairly direct parallel to something that the governor said yesterday, which is that he kind of felt like I think you actually played this clip at the top of us chatting here, which is that he thought what Republicans presented and what he, you know, eventually signed was kind of a false choice. It was making a choice between cutting taxes and investing in state programs. And the governor said, we could have done more. We could have invested more state money in things like schools, and we should have. You know, these two things can coexist, but Republicans didn't agree with him to the extent that, you know, that he wanted them to. Now, there are increases for schools. There's a $128 million increase over what, you know, the state spent during the last budget. But in context, the governor wanted a $1.6 billion increase for K-12 schools. So pretty big gap there. And I think that really does kind of reflect the, you know, the primary conflict between these two parties, which is, you know, the governor and Democrats saying we really need to invest more state resources at a time when we have them, and Republicans saying we need to return this money to taxpayers. It's their money. They know how to spend it.
Staying in that vein, you know, the governor said, hey, this isn't exactly the budget I would sign, but I want to do what's best for Wisconsin residents. You have Republicans saying, well, it's our budget, so we deserve credit for it. What are we hearing from members of the governor's own party about how the budget basically shook out?
Yeah, this was an interesting dynamic because the majority of Democrats voted against the budget. It passed the state legislature with some bipartisan support. Seven Democrats joined all Republicans in voting for it. So a lot of Democrats were in the position of, you know, their party's governor signing a budget that they didn't support on the floor. And the way that we saw the Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz respond, I think, is a good example of how Democrats are going to talk about this budget. Hintz basically said, you know, the governor was acting in the best interests of the state by signing this budget, you know, kind of harkened back to what I said before about, you know, if we didn't have a budget, we might lose some of this federal money. There could be more kind of political fighting that could put that in jeopardy. So Evers sort of stepped outside of that potential political fight and signed something that he wasn't completely happy with. But I think from Democrats, we'll continue to see a conversation about making more state investments outside of the budget, using some of that money that's still in the state's general fund after this process to sort of revisit state spending and say, hey, we've got some money. Why don't we send more to schools, more to, you know, other priorities, and that conversation isn't really done yet, even though the budget is in place.
Now, we are in 2021. 2022 is right around the corner. So we have the midterms where Governor Evers, should he decide to run for reelection, this is the year that he is going to do it. How do we see the political fight, specifically with the budget, you know, spilling into the midterm election coming up?
So we do know the governor's running again. That's 100% going to happen. We don't know for sure who his Republican opponent is going to be at this point, but I think we know for sure that we're going to be talking about what this budget had, what it didn't have. We'll talk about the tax cut. We'll talk about education funding. I think in a lot of ways, it's going to be similar to the campaign that Evers ran in 2018. He's going to focus on schools, healthcare, roads. I think Republicans are going to, you know, push back on the governor attempting to talk about the tax cut, say it wasn't his thing, it was their thing. I think we'll see conversations about, you know, how the pandemic was handled in Wisconsin, how some of the unrest last summer was handled in Wisconsin. So it's always a little bit dangerous to guess what we're going to be talking about a year from now. But I think if we had to venture into the realm of conjecture here, I think it's fairly safe to say that those are things that are going to come up before voters head to the polls in 22.
Laurel, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR's State Capitol reporter. She's also the co-host of the WPR Politics podcast, and she was with us today to talk about the state budget, which Governor Tony Evers signed yesterday. And if you can't get enough budget talk, you can check out the podcast, but they will also be talking about this on the morning show after 7 on Monday. It's no surprise that the pandemic disrupted just about every aspect of our daily lives. And for people with families, the transition to quarantine was an altogether tough order. This is especially true for women who, for the most part, ended up shouldering the burden of both work and childcare. But in many cases, working moms ended up leaving their jobs altogether, either through their own difficult choices or, in some cases, getting furloughed or laid off. Our next guest interviewed several women about their experiences during the pandemic and what could come next for women as they plan their next steps. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How did the pandemic impact working moms in your life? If you stayed home to take care of your kids, what was that decision like for you and your family? If you haven't gone back to work, what effect has the decision had on your identity, professional or otherwise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Claire Kane Miller is a correspondent for The New York Times, where she writes about gender, families, and the future of work for The Upshot. Claire, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go back about 15 to 16 months. Remind us what the immediate impact of the pandemic and lockdowns were for working moms across the country.
So 5.5 million of them almost immediately stopped working. They were laid off, they quit, schools closed, and someone needed to watch their children. There was no backup plan, and so they left. This came just after women had achieved a milestone for the first time. They were more than half of workers in America, and then all of a sudden, 5.5 million of them left the workforce.
And, you know, this is something that women had been working for decades, maybe not intentionally, but many women wanted to pursue careers and have a family at the same time. This wasn't anything new. So what happened we know what happened, but schools went online and women basically had to shoulder the burden of that. Even with those strides, it seems like women basically kind of got pushed back a little.
Yes, it in a lot of families, it looked very much like the 1950s again. And there are good reasons for it. One was, if we can remember back to two marches ago when schools closed, preschools also closed, childcare closed. It didn't feel safe to have grandparents or aunts and uncles or neighbors or anybody watching your kids. So somebody had to be home with children. And then another factor is that this whole time that women have been making these enormous strides in the workforce, they've also been taking more flexible jobs, because it's always been true that there's not a lot of support when your child needs something. If a child, you know, the school calls and says they're sick in the middle of the day and they need to come home, or there's a school break for a teacher in-service day, for all these reasons, parents have needed some flexibility, and it's often been women taking those more flexible jobs in order to be able to do that. And then when the pandemic hit, it seemed obvious that they were the ones that were going to take it on because they already had the more flexible jobs. But of course, when they took flexible jobs, they never intended for schools to close for 16 months. That was never part of the plan.
We are talking to Claire Kane Miller right now. She's a correspondent for the New York Times. She writes about gender, families, and the future of work for The Upshot. And we're talking about the economic brunt that women in particular took during the pandemic. The New York Times and the Morning Consult surveyed mothers recently. What did those survey results show?
They showed that it was a nationally representative sample of parents and of mothers who were working for pay prior to the pandemic. And they showed that about a fifth had left their jobs. Another fifth had considered seriously leaving their jobs. And, you know, because this has just been very hard, even for those who have managed to hold on to some employment. And most surprising to me is it showed that in the vast majority of families, 80% of families in which the mother left, there was never even a discussion about which parent was going to stop working. It was just obviously the mother was the default, and the default was for the father to keep being the breadwinner, which really stretches back to, you know, gender stereotypes that we've had for a very long time, but that don't really reflect the way that a lot of American families were living pre-pandemic, because the majority of mothers were also working for pay.
Now, you spoke with 15 mothers in Los Angeles County. What are some of the stories you heard from those mothers that stand out to you?
So we talked to women from a wide range of backgrounds, different racial backgrounds, single mothers, gay mothers, mothers who were rich, mothers who were poor, mothers who had college educations, mothers who didn't. And the thing that struck me most is that they all mentioned one thing in common, which was that they felt a loss of identity. They had felt that their job gave them another identity. It gave them, you know, a place in the world. It gave them a way to feed their family and pay their bills. And now they felt that their identity had shrunk to just being mother. And it struck me that really across their circumstances, this was true. Some of these women, you know, one was quarantining, writing out the pandemic at their vacation home in Mexico. She was obviously very privileged. She had taken time off after her son was born until he entered kindergarten, and she was just feeling so happy to be back at work as an acupuncturist, and felt that, you know, she had to give that up again. And then on the other end of the economic spectrum, I talked to some of these women who had been house cleaners or hotel cleaners who had lost their jobs because it wasn't safe to go to those places, or those places closed, and also because someone needed to be home with their children. But they still needed to pay their bills, and so they became very resourceful. One woman told me that she was using her food stamps to buy produce at the grocery store and then resell it on the sidewalk. And another had used the internet hotspot that the school had given her sons in order to watch YouTube videos on how to make masks. And then she started sewing them and selling them around the neighborhood. And these are people who had to become very creative just to figure out how to get by.
And so, you know, throughout your conversations, you talked to women who felt as though, you know, it was basically on them to make the decision to provide childcare during what was, we didn't know how long quarantine was going to last. We didn't know how long schools were going to be out. And so do you think that there was a belief maybe at the beginning that, okay, maybe for a couple weeks, maybe a month or more, you know, this would be fine. Did the women say anything about what then felt like kind of an endless quarantine in their experience?
Yes, I think a lot of them felt that at the beginning they reacted in emergency mode. My kids need my care. Obviously, I need to step up. This is what I'm going to do. And then as the days became harder in Los Angeles County, like most of the schools on the West Coast and many in other parts of the country, it never opened full time this year. It only opened in a part-time capacity in April of this last spring. So, and then of course, you know, camps and summer are disrupted. Nobody's quite sure what fall will bring. So there is this feeling of nobody knows quite when it's going to be possible for them to fully go back to work. And I think a lot of them expressed feeling a little bit forgotten as people get vaccinated and things reopen and people move on, that they still are home with their children who are unvaccinated because they're under 12 and with no certainty about school opening full time in the fall. And just child care is still quite disruptive. And there is a sense of sort of this never ending drudgery and a lot of question marks.
We are talking to Claire Kane Miller right now. She is a correspondent for the New York Times, where she writes about gender, families, and the future of work for The Upshot. And she's with us today to talk about how the pandemic affected mothers in the workforce, especially as many of them had to switch gears and provide childcare almost 100% during the pandemic, especially as schools closed. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a mother, how did you and your family experience the pandemic? Did you and your spouse evenly divide labor, or did you feel as though one parent shouldered more of the responsibility? Or if you're a single parent, how did working and providing childcare impact your day-to-day life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in a minute right here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the pandemic and working moms and the impact quarantine, the closures of schools had on families, but in particular, women. Claire Kane Miller is with us from the New York Times, and you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. We want to hear about your experience during the pandemic. If you had been working and then had to switch gears to provide childcare, maybe even teach your kids as they learned Zoom, all that. Were you able to continue working, or did you have to cut back on your hours? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Claire, before the break, we were talking about this series of interviews that you have been doing with women in Los Angeles County, and they were talking about their ideas. Identities and how they kind of felt like they had lost something, you know, by not having their career. And it didn't just impact white collar workers, but it also impacted people who might work in retail and things like that. And you said one thing that stood out to me earlier in our conversation about, hey, you know, when this all went down, there was almost no discussion about maybe the father stepping in, maybe quitting work or scaling back. It was really on women. In the women that you talked to, how did they talk about this dynamic in particular?
Some of them just took it as a given. Many of them mentioned that their husbands make more money, significantly more money than they did. So it was obvious. But that's, of course, a vicious cycle. Women and men at American jobs make about the same until they have children. That's when the pay gap opens. And it's because women do more caregiving, or else employers assume they will. And thus they're paid less. And so then when there is a caregiving need, they leave work to take it. And so then they're continued to be paid less. So that's a cycle. Some of them, you know, said, some of them said they had already been managing if they had a child with disabilities, if they, you know, had young children who were only in part-time preschool, that they'd already sort of managed the children while working. And so they sort of fell into it, and others were pretty frustrated. It felt, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, if we can remember back, like it was a very acute situation. And like you said earlier, people didn't know how long it would last, and it felt sort of like an emergency. And there's been a lot of research that shows worldwide, not just in the United States, that when children have an emergency, like, childhood cancer or something like that, it's the mother who steps up. That's a deep, deep cultural phenomenon across cultures, especially in the United States. And so a lot of them just said that that's what they were doing. But it's when it extended past a year and a half that they really started to worry. They said their marriages, you know, had fallen into this pattern where they were a stay-at-home parent, and that had never been how they intended to divide the domestic labor. And they were worried that since it had gone on so long, you know, how were they going to get out of it? Some also felt guilty that they had contributed to the household income, and then all of a sudden their partner was having to do it on their own, on, you know, his or her own. And that made them feel very guilty, even though they were obviously doing this important work of being with the children during the day.
So at some point, we don't have a date on it. You know, some schools will open fully in person. There still might be a hybrid situation, but at some point quarantine will end, and women will likely want to get back into the workforce. Not all of them, but many of them probably will. What do experts expect to happen to these moms, moving forward after the pandemic?
Sure. In our survey, 70% of the mothers who had worked before the pandemic and left said they did want to return. 15% weren't sure, and 15% didn't. They had found, you know, a new life that worked better for them this way. It's always been hard, especially in American workplaces where caregiving, family caregiving is sort of frowned upon. Workers are penalized for having those responsibilities. It's been hard for people who take breaks for those reasons. But there is some hope that unlike a personal break that you took for just your own family reason, this is a societal wide thing. There is some hope that employers will be able to look at this break on resumes and understand that it really wasn't a choice and understand what happened there. There's also some policy things that could happen. One idea that has been floated by some Democrats is giving tax incentives to employers who hire back women who had to leave for childcare reasons so that they're not starting again at the bottom of the ladder, or they're not starting again at minimum wage, and they don't have to go searching for a new job. There's also been a lot of talk about some of these industries that probably won't come back as robust a way as they were before, like some of the service industries, hotels, restaurants. It remains to be seen whether those will start back. So there's been some policy ideas about retraining for women who worked, or parents who worked in those industries and were forced to leave so that they could maybe switch into other jobs. And interestingly, some of the women I talked to said that this break, even though it's not what they planned on and not what they would have chosen, and it had been hard, it had also given them time to think about their career path. And some of them have decided not to go back to the industries they were in before. A couple said they decided to start their own businesses or become, you know, social workers or in-home caregivers because that was basically the work they'd been doing for their families the past year, and they realized they're very good at it. So in some ways, it provided some new career opportunities, even if they came at a cost.
You know, this conversation also reminds me of some other conversations that we've had at the policy level about what is there and really what isn't there to help families in the United States as a whole. And childcare has been one that has come up. Obviously, it wasn't a safe time to have kids in childcare. But do you think that potentially there could be some fresh eyes on having a more robust child care system moving forward, maybe even universal preschool at some point, to kind of close the gap between men and women, since this cultural idea is going to keep persisting unless there's some intervention?
Absolutely. And President Biden has proposed both national paid leave, paid family leave, which the United States is the only rich country that does not have that, as well as universal preschool. I think his proposal starts at age 3. And both of those things would have been very helpful here. There was a brief federal paid leave for coronavirus school closures, although it ended at the end of 2020. some states have kept paid leave programs going, but it's shown that, you know, when there's an emergency and your family needs care, you really can't work. It's really shown the need for paid leave. And while you're right that it wasn't safe for kids to go to childcare centers for a while and they closed, I think what this period has done is really made it undeniable how much childcare is essential for people to do their paid work in a way that maybe people hadn't thought about or paid much attention to who didn't have young kids at home, because that's who either had to quit their job or who has, you know, been working at dawn and after midnight, sneaking any time in they can, or just getting completely burnt out. Children showing up in Zoom meetings. We've all seen how difficult it is to not have childcare while you're trying to do paid work. And so, you know, I think a lot of policymakers who support universal childcare are hoping that people see the need in a way they may not have.
As someone that, you know, watches for trends and all of that with families and work, you know, what do you have your eye on moving forward, certainly maybe even generally, but as we emerge from the pandemic?
Well, one thing I think is interesting is the fact that a lot of parents are still not able to go back to their careers full time because there's still a lot of uncertainty about childcare. And I think for people who are vaccinated and without young children in states that have reopened, they may not realize that schools have not yet put out their plans. Even when schools open, they may not be opening aftercare. Camps are not operating at full capacity, and children under 12 are not yet vaccinated. So there's still a feeling of limbo for parents of young children. I also think it'll be very interesting to watch what happens with workplaces as they reopen and demand that workers come back to offices or that essential workers, you know, go back to their full-time regular schedules, because a lot of workers have seen, you know, how nice it was to be home and not commuting for their family dinner, or to be able to pick up their child at 3 o'clock from school and then, you know, take their child somewhere else. It's not that their workday ended at three, but it's that they had that flexibility to go do that at three whenever school closed. And I think we're going to see a lot more workers demanding that and asking their employers to keep some of those things, those ways that they've learned to balance work and family that ended up working a lot better for a lot of families, and they're not really ready to give up.
And do you think that workplaces will respond, or do you think we could end up back where we were before the pandemic?
It's really unclear. Some workplaces are already, you know, allowing those things. A lot of workplaces, white collar workplaces with offices, are doing these hybrid schedules where maybe people are in the office 3 days and at home 2 days. And it seems from what I've seen, the workplaces are much more open to talking about childcare needs instead of it just being up to the individual to figure out. They're sending out these surveys, you know, asking what people need in terms of their scheduling when working around their families. But, you know, I also think there's a really strong drive, especially among, you know, especially in corporate America and companies that have been around working one way for a long time, to get back to the way it was before. And, you know, one thing that I've heard a lot of researchers say that they fear is that if everyone in senior leadership goes back, and then the only people who keep working flexibly or remotely are parents of young children or other people with certain needs that make it harder for them to go to the office, then they'll just be penalized the way that they always have been if they're the only ones who aren't there in person.
Well, Claire, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Claire Kane Miller, correspondent for The New York Times, talking about families amid the pandemic.